Welcome to Talk World Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
This week on Talk World Radio, we are speaking with Craig Unger about a wonderful new book called Den of Spies. Craig Unger is the New York Times bestselling author of 6 books on the Republican Party's assault on democracy, including House of Bush, House of Saud, House of Trump, House of Putin, and now Den of Spies, a real-life political thriller about how master spy William Casey put together a treasonous covert operation in 1980 that hijacked American foreign policy and stole the election for Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush. Craig Unger, welcome to Talk World Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Thanks for writing this book. I think it's sort of doubly a valuable book because it's the evidence that Casey and gang got Iran weapons and persuaded Iran to keep U.S. hostages longer so Jimmy Carter would lose and Reagan would win. But it's also the account of how difficult it was to get that evidence and to get media outlets to tell the truth. Why did you decide to tell it this way rather than just laying out the case?
Right. I've done 6 books now on the Republican Party's assault on democracy. And this was different in that it was personal, and it was personal because reluctantly, I was sort of a character in it. I was trying to unravel this back in 1991. To me, it's a great spy story. At the time, Elliot Richardson, who'd been Attorney General of the United States, told me this was much bigger than Watergate, a scandal that was much bigger than Watergate. It was arguably an act of treason. The Republicans were not in power at the time, and they made a secret alliance with the militant mullahs of Iran, in which they not only illegally sent weapons to Iran, which was considered horrific at the time, because Iran was an enemy that held America, it was a hostile foreign power that held Americans as hostage. But in return for those weapons, the Republicans made a deal saying, don't release the hostages, prolong their incarceration until after the election. That way Reagan will win and we'll be nice to you after the election.
And the Iranians weren't subtle about it, right? They released the hostages within minutes of Reagan becoming president, right?
Right. The Onion magazine, the satirical magazine, actually did a book looking back on the 20th century. And for that day, they did a parody of the New York Times with the headline saying, Ronald Reagan inaugurated, urges America not to put 2 and 2 together. And so on some level, it was incredibly obvious because Reagan couldn't possibly have negotiated while he was president. He'd only been president for 3 minutes. He was still on the podium when they were released. And yet there they were released. And no one seemed to get it in America. I started reporting on it in 1991. At the time, George H.W. Bush, Bush Sr., was president of the United States. He was about to run for re-election, and he was allegedly part of the whole conspiracy. So this was a big, big deal back in 91, and it was covered up in a way that, to me, that was shocking. And I think it was one of the most egregious failures on the part of the American press I've ever seen. And it's also worth looking at in terms of what we see today, because we see the Republicans doing this again and again and again, these assaults on democracy. Back then, they did it secretly. Now they're doing it in the open.
Well, it was unlikely that Iran unilaterally, just to spite Carter, released the hostages in that moment with Reagan and gang having not done a thing. But conceivable, if not for the evidence that you lay out in the book. So if you could summarize what the case is, who was at the meetings, when and where, and the weapons shipments and everything you uncovered.
Absolutely. And I think we really, this time I really have literally the receipts, that is invoices for the weapons shipments. And they were done by, I mean, this was a real thriller, spy thriller story with cutouts and double agents. And the key double agents were a pair of Iranian brothers who were arms dealers, Cyrus and Jamshid Hashemi. And I have videotapes of Jamshid being interviewed saying how they went in, that they were really allies of the Carter administration didn't know it. And this is one of the things that I've discovered is that Bill Casey, who was Reagan's campaign manager, and I think one of the most brilliant spies in American history, but he had a secret intelligence network while he was a private citizen. He was not in the CIA. He had been in the OSS, the precursor to the CIA during World War II. But a lot of time had passed and he was not in the CIA. Yet he was meeting with Israeli intelligence. High-level officials in Israel told me that. And Jamshid Hashemi, I have videotapes of him saying how he met with Casey. His brother had known Casey back in the early, in the mid-70s. And they went to Jimmy Carter saying they would help solve the hostage crisis, but they were secretly working for Bill Casey and sabotaging the Carter administration.
There's so many points in the book. We can't get to them all, but I found it illuminating the incident where there's this, you know, London alibi scam for Casey, and the calendar of the conference in London is published in the media outlets as evidence that he was there. But if you knew how to look at it, it was evidence that he was not there. Am I summarizing that right?
Absolutely. It was shocking to me going through this. At the time I was with Newsweek, and I think your younger listeners may not realize, but this is 30 years ago, and the old media had real power back then. I mean, Time and Newsweek, the three TV networks, ABC, NBC, and CBS, shaped, and the New York Times and Washington Post, they shaped the national conversation. So I was, relatively speaking, well-positioned to really expose this story. And we had evidence in terms of attendance sheets that were supposedly Casey's alibi. But if you looked at them closely, and you didn't have to look at them that closely, the markings on the attendance sheet were made in ink if he attended, but in lightly penciled in if they were supposed to attend. And that was the case for William Casey. I talked to the man who took the attendance sheets in London, and this was a phony alibi. And what we encountered again and again and again was disinformation and phony alibis that were repeatedly surfaced to discredit reporters like me.
It seems like it often happens. I'm thinking of the case of Gary Webb and CIA drug dealing, that these big media outlets will take a story seriously and report it responsibly. And then somebody will flip a switch and they'll all declare that it's bogus. It's been debunked. It's been disproven. This is a story for wackos. We aren't going to cover it henceforth. Why does that happen?
Well, that was precisely what happened in this case. And Newsweek actually did three consecutive stories saying it didn't happen, it didn't happen, it didn't happen. And if you know news, news is about things happening. When something doesn't happen, you don't necessarily write a story about it. And the reason for the Swiss, why did Newsweek do a 180? And they weren't the only ones. The New Republic and a lot of organs of the so-called liberal press did this. And I think there were two factors in it. One was there was a lot of disinformation coming from Israel. And I've been attacked for saying this a lot, but when you look at the October surprise, you see Israel, which is supposedly an ally of the United States, they have secretly allied with the Republicans and with the militant Islamic fundamentalists in Iran to sabotage an American presidential election. And an ally like Israel is not supposed to do that. That's an attack on our sovereignty. So there was a lot of disinformation coming into reporters about that. What I was reporting was taboo, and they were not going to allow it to surface. And the other part of it is, I think, what is known as access journalism. And that happens a lot with the Washington Press Corps, who wants to cozy up to the great powers that be in Washington and get a steady supply of stories from powerful, well-known people, whether it's Henry Kissinger or Bill Casey or key people in the Reagan administration. And that was going on as well. And I think it's really hard to fight that when you're doing investigative reporting.
And not only are you doing reporting on professional liars, which has to be one of the hardest types of reporting, but a lot of the evidence you found and that Bob Perry found on this story came from the investigations Congress did, but didn't follow through on, didn't make public, evidence they buried in their files, right? So this wasn't just a media job. This was a congressional cover up.
Right. I have to salute my late colleague, Bob Perry, who did enormous, who made more, he was absolutely relentless on this, and he made more progress on this story than anyone, including myself. And one of his great, one of the great things he did is he went into the bowels of Congress, literally these abandoned rooms, an abandoned ladies' room in the Rayburn office building in Washington. And he found cardboard boxes full of documents that a congressional investigation had discovered. And some of them really, really were probative. Among them, Congress had reached out to the KGB in Russia and said, do you have any information on the October surprise? And believe it or not, Russia responded with a six-page report and they buried it. And Bob Perry found it in boxes that had been hidden from the public. They were left in an abandoned ladies' room under the tampon dispenser. And Bob rescued those files. And Bob died several years ago. And when he died, his wife gave me those documents. And some of them are just amazing because, and I think Bob didn't get to them all, but they did include literally the receipts of arms deals from the Hashemi brothers that ended up in the office of the president of Iran. And they were very much part of the October surprise.
This thing took you many years. It wasn't exactly the ideal career path in U.S. media. Imagine if not just you and Bob and three other people, but all the major media outlets and the congressional committees had done it quickly and thoroughly and publicized the results. What difference would it have made?
I think it could have made enormous difference. And it was coming up for the 1992 election as it was. Bill Clinton won, so it probably wouldn't have made a difference there, but I think that you know we have to know our history. I mean, it's the oldest cliche in the book that those who forget history are condemned to repeat it. And in this case, I think you see the degrading of the American press force over time up until today, when it's where the media is incredibly weak. When I started out in journalism, these were the days of Watergate, the Pentagon Papers, the My Lai massacre. There were times when one huge investigative story could change the course of history. And a lot of these stories are stories we remember 50 years later, whereas everyone sort of forgot the October surprise. And I think you see today the press is weaker than ever before. The Washington Post and New York Times are shadows of themselves. I think the mainstream newscasts of the CBS, NBC are really don't affect they don't move the needle. And you know you're able to do stories that Donald Trump is a felon 34 times over. He's a rapist, an adjudicated rapist. And people yawn and it doesn't really change things. And that's where we are today. And it's especially disturbing as the new administration takes place. And I think we're living through a coup d'etat as we speak.
Of course, Reagan was a film actor, which is sort of what Trump is. And the story was sort of put out that anything bad that happened under Reagan, he didn't know about it. He was too incompetent to have even understood it. And William Casey mumbled so badly, nobody knew what he was saying anyway. But isn't there a precedent because he's responsible for what anything his subordinates do, whether he knows about it or not?
Well, that was Harry Truman's old slogan, was the buck stops here. And Reagan always had a deniability, and I think Casey very cleverly built that in. Casey, his nickname was Mumbles, and no one could understand what he's saying, as you mentioned. I mean, he's a wonderful character. I say he's sort of a cross between James Bond and Mr. Magoo. He had horrible table manners. He'd spill food over himself when he ate, and it was always, the joke was, if he wanted to be Secretary of State, but Nancy Reagan, who was so fastidious, couldn't imagine the idea of this slob presiding over state dinners. And Casey was always going in a dozen different directions at once. So no one knew everything that was going on. And that was another level of deniability that was built in. He ended up wearing disguises. He wore a wig. I was actually able to get to one of Casey's political operatives, a guy named Robert Cenci, who set up some of the key meetings in Madrid where Casey was meeting directly with his Iranian counterparts and setting up the October surprise. And he told me that Casey traveled under the name of Daniel O'Neill, wearing a blonde wig and wearing a disguise. So there was a lot of, spy versus spy kind of hijinks going on.
It sounds like it. We're speaking with Craig Unger, and the book I highly recommend is called Den of Spies: Reagan, Carter, and the Secret History of the Treason That Stole the White House. Why is this still left out of history books? Why do not just major media corporations, but serious historians simply leave it out?
Well, I think we've seen the demise of media for a lot of reasons. One is social media, I think, is just crippling it, and we don't know what truth is anymore. If anyone has been on what was Twitter and is now X, you can see how someone like Elon Musk is able to manipulate the national conversation. I mean, this is just one aspect of it, and it happens at Facebook as well. But I've been sort of, they're calling it shadow banned on Twitter, where I built up a significant following. But if I do something, that if I tweet something or post something that's critical of Trump, I used to get 600,000, 800,000 page views. Now, if it's critical of Trump, I may get 600 page views or under 1,000. And you get a sense that they are tinkering with the algorithms in a way to hype everything that's posted by the right and to mute anything that comes from people like me. And that's just one aspect. I think people are scared. I have to admit, if I were to do I did two books on Trump, as you noted, House of Trump, House of Putin, and American Compromise. If I were to do another like that, I have to wonder, would I be sued? I mean, it's very easy for someone like Musk, with nearly $500 billion, to do a nuisance suit that may have no merit whatsoever against me or any member of the press, and suddenly you have to hire lawyers, you're tied up in court for 5 or 6 years, you may lose your home, and that has a horrible chilling effect on the press.
I wanted to ask you, I haven't read your books on Trump, and I haven't seen the evidence that you cite in one sentence in Den of Spies. You say that Trump was elected, quote, with considerable help from Russian President Vladimir Putin. Do you actually have evidence of that?
Yes, I think all the way they were releasing the emails was about Hillary's emails just in time. This coincided, or it came immediately after Trump said, his famous "grab him by the pussy" remark was, and suddenly that was muted by one story after another about Hillary's emails, and the emails were dribbling out. In addition, a lot of that stuff went to material went to Cambridge Analytica, which was also releasing material. And what I write about principally in House of Trump is Trump's reliance on the Russian mafia and how they saved him and how he made millions. Trump had six bankruptcies, but he came back into some amount of money by laundering money for the Russian mafia through Trump real estate. And more specifically, in 1984, a guy named David Bogatin, who, according to FBI files, was in the Russian mafia, went into Trump Tower, met with Trump, put down $6 million in cash, and said he would take five condos. And presto, he's able to, when he sells those condos, he's able to attribute the money to real estate transactions. And the money has, in effect, been launders. And I found 13 people affiliated with the Russian mafia who were either living in Trump Tower or owned properties in other Trump buildings who were doing this. So this was an ongoing proposition for Trump, and it was a way to make a lot of money. He later...
the guy has corrupt dealings around the world with Russians, Americans, Canadians, French, everyone.
Absolutely.
How did any of it get him elected? And you didn't mention Vladimir Putin.
Well, the Russian mafia is an offshoot of Russian intelligence. It works hand in hand with them. And I go into this great detail in the book. But the Russian mafia is allowed to hold forth as long as they are working within the confines of what was then the KGB and is now the FSB wants. And that essentially means Vladimir Putin.
Seems like a couple of big leaps there, one to get to Putin and one to get to changing the election results. But I'll read the book and then and see what it tells me. But I wonder what you think of the stories now under Trump. Everybody at the CIA is being, you know, fired or offered a buyout. We see this parallel to Jimmy Carter having fired people at the CIA, and they went about their business anyway and set up a new organization. And you may see parallels to Kennedy firing people at the CIA, which at least the majority of the U.S. public thinks led to something pretty bad.
Well, I'm actually seeing parallels with what Vladimir Putin did, which is the way they worked hand in glove with the Russian mafia. And again, this is what I write about in House of Trump, House of Putin, is there's a man named Semyon Mogilevich, who is a multi billionaire Russian mobster. And he was directing the Russian mafia. And I mentioned earlier a guy named David Bogatin, who is one of Mogilevich's lieutenants. And there, that was the direct link to the Russian mafia, because Bogatin bought a lot of Trump real estate. So that's an important part of it.
It seems like much of the U.S. public, it's not doing them any good. They're not getting active and strategically changing the world. But a lot of people are aware of a lot of Trump's misdeeds. Not so much the October surprise. Is there any polling? Does the U.S. public have any idea that this even happened?
I think mostly no. I mean, there are historians like Douglas Brinkley, Kai Bird, and a number of others who acknowledge that it happened. And Jonathan Alter in his biography, and Kai Bird in his biography of Carter, both acknowledged that it happened, and they revealed, Kai Bird revealed some stuff that would not been revealed before about it. So I think serious historians have started to take it seriously. But, our media system, I think, has broken down in the United States. It's become so atomized and siloed that people never get out of their silo. And as I say, I've written six books about Republican misdeeds, but I don't think they ever really cross over into the other world. Three of them have been bestsellers, but it's within the confines of the more literate liberal audience. And it's very, very hard to cross over. Fox News is not going to have me on TV, nor will the Oath Keepers or Joe Rogan or any of those.
It would be nice if there were serious and civil debates on U.S. television, as to some extent there were many years ago.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's one of the lessons of Den of Spies, is you start to see the end of the national conversation as the product of civil discourse, and in which we share the same facts. When I started in journalism, it was during the Vietnam War, but when the Pentagon Papers came out, we shared the same facts. And CBS and New York Times and all that were taken seriously as distributing reality. That's no longer the truth. They cry fake news, and we never sort of penetrate into the other half of the country.
We've got just a couple minutes left. There was evidence in your book, perhaps not conclusive, that there were other sabotage efforts of peace in the Middle East and of Carter's military rescue attempt as well. Do you think that was sabotaged?
Right. I think it's quite possible. But again, I don't think the evidence is conclusive on that. I think it is conclusive about the October surprise. But by April of 1980, Carter had been negotiating or trying to negotiate with Iran for 4 or 5 months. He'd been getting nowhere. The hostages, there was no sign the hostages were going to be released. And he said it was time to take some military action. And this was, he sent a mission where the aircraft carrier, the Nimitz, Admiral Nimitz, had eight choppers and several cargo planes on, and they went to the coast of Iran, and they were going to rescue the hostages. But three of the eight helicopters crashed, and it was a tragic operation in which eight Americans were killed. There were a lot of evidence that this very secret mission, evidence about it, leaked out from some of Carter's enemies who had been in the CIA, in American intelligence. And there were reports about it in various newspapers all over the world, really. And the reasons behind the sabotage were never clearly, definitively addressed. So we don't know the answer to that definitively.
To be determined. I highly recommend looking at all the evidence in this book, Den of Spies, Reagan, Carter, and the Secret History of the Treason That Stole the White House, by Craig Unger. Craig, thank you for writing your books and for coming on Talk World Radio.
Well, thanks for having me, David. I appreciate it.
This is Talk World Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. Read or listen to today's Peace Almanac entry at peacealmanac.org. All past shows can be heard at talkworldradio.org. Talk World Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way.